Okay, so in my attempt to sort of make sure I filled up the time, I ended up writing a talk much too long. So I'm going to have to sort of hop, skip, and jump. So I'm delighted and deeply honored to be giving the American Philosophical Association Central Division presidential address for its 115th meeting. So far as I know, unless someone was consciously or unconsciously passing, I am only the third black president in the APA's history. The previous two. Now, is there applause for the increase in numbers, or thank God we've only had so few? The previous two being Kwame Anthony Appiah for the Eastern Division and Ken Taylor for the Pacific Division. But so rapidly are things changing, at least in institutional leadership level, that we already have a fourth coming up next year in the impressive form of Anita Allen for the Eastern Division. So before you start your hashtag philosophy so white campaign, you should recognize that the APA leadership, of which of course I'm not part, so I have to say this, is doing what it can at the executive level to diversify the profession. The crucial question is, of course, how long it will take to affect the broader demography, currently 97% white in my estimate, and the curriculum content. That content will be my theme today. Obviously, there's no requirement that black philosophers work and lecture on race, but unless some of us do, syllabi and curricula are likely to remain the same, which is clearly problematic given the nation's impending shift to a non-white majority. And as Jennifer has made plain, race has in fact been my main research focus for the past two decades plus. Besides, it's Black History Month. Have you ever heard an APA president utter that sentence before? Probably not. Besides, it's Black History Month, and we're all supposed to be doing what we can to bring the African-American experience more centrally into the national conversation, especially given the value of the discipline's distinct perspective on these themes. Finally, the dramatic events, I was joking, I am going to refer to a president. Finally, the dramatic events since our new president's election, blood and soil indeed. Ask yourselves, would your grandparents who fought in World War II or otherwise supported the war effort against fascism have dreamed that three quarters of a century later, that chant could be heard on American soil? So the dramatic events of the past year plus should have brought home to even the most stubborn post-racialists that race as a central reality has not exactly vanished from American life. Insofar as philosophers like to think that we have the franchise on issues of justice, I don't believe anybody else actually does, but we do. It would seem that present circumstances call with particular urgency on our special talents and expertise in this era. And that brings me to my actual title, what it says in the program, just being a stopgap until I could come up with something suitably snappy. So here it is. Through a glass, whitely, : ideal theory as epistemic injustice. So the reference is, of course, to John Rawls and the vast body of work his writing has inspired. For those of us of a certain age who vividly recall our first encounter with Rawls in grad school, only a few years after Theory of Justice's publication, it is difficult to absorb the fact that the book is now approaching its 50th anniversary. Its age and our own age are both alarmingly advanced. I should hasten to add, however, that as a precocious child, barely out of my teens when I completed the PhD. Doubtless, even as I speak, numerous events, commemorations, critical forums, retrospectives, are being organized to mark this day. However, this paper is not going to be any kind of attempted synoptic overview, but focus more tightly and critically on a central Rawlsian concept which I would claim has still not been sufficiently interrogated, ideal theory. In ideal theory as ideology, which according to Google Scholar has until recently been my most cited essay, though in the last few weeks it has been overtaken by white ignorance. I'm not sure what this means, but I'm sure it means something. In this essay, I argued, as the title declares, that ideal theory was profoundly flawed as a normative orientation or meta-orientation, and that it served more to obfuscate than illuminate crucial factual and socio-political realities. At the time of its writing, which was way back in 2004, I was unaware of the research of Miranda Fricker, now, of course, my distinguished colleague at the CUNY Graduate Center. Her Epistemic Injustice would not be published until 2007. But though, as we all know, considering the popularity of the concept, she would work things out in far more impressive detail, we are in key respects exploring the same terrain, motivated by the same set of concerns. The deeply problematic methodology of ideal theory in a world where social injustice and related epistemic injustice are not the deviations from the norm, not the outliers, but constitute the norm. Nonetheless, I should emphasize that Miranda should not be blamed for any of the outrageous things I will go on to say in this paper, since I have not shown it to her or even discussed it with her. My thesis then, as stated in the phrase after the colon, which you might have been wondering whether you misheard, not ideal theory and epistemic injustice, but more controversially, ideal theory as itself a form of epistemic injustice. So the paper's in three sections. In the first part, I will discuss the utopian and dystopian imaginaries in both fiction and nonfiction. In the second part, I will focus on whiteopias. In the third part, I will make a case for Rawlsian ideal theory as a whiteopian project, and as such, one involving systemic epistemic injustice. Section one. So let's start with the utopian and dystopian traditions and their respective imaginaries. The connection to Rawlsianism, of course, is that in his ideal theory of a well-ordered society, Rawls saw himself as realizing, within a liberal contractarian framework, the realistic utopia that the non-liberal Rousseau envisaged in the social contract, the vision of a dramatically better society that was nonetheless attainable, quote, taking men as they are and laws as they might be. I suggest that particularly when driven by concerns of class, gender, or race, what the majority of such work has in common is the linking of utopia and dystopia, whether in fiction or in monographs and manifestos. By this, I don't mean the projected utopia that turns into a dystopia, as in the unhappy 20th century attempts to realize a socialist dream, classically George Orwell's 1984, of course, but also its predecessor and significant influence, Yevgeny Zamyatin's We. Rather, I'm referring to the fact that the counterfactual utopian future is made to shine more brightly in specific contrast to the actual dystopian present. Karl Marx famously scorned what he called utopian socialism, but this was not because of its vision of a radically different and superior social order, but because he thought the hoped-for dynamic of transition and prescriptions for social reconstruction were unrealistic, whether capitalist philanthropy or Christian moral exhortation. What was required was the overthrow of capitalism through political organization and struggle, ultimately resulting in working class seizure of the means of production, which would, he believed, bring an end to the hell on earth conditions for the proletariat that he had described in Capital, that his political and literary partner, Friedrich Engels, had earlier reported on in his muckraking, The Condition of the Working Class in England. Neither of them would ever go into much detail on what the new socialist society would look like. To a significant extent, the vision of an alternative future would be more influentially sketched by the writers of fiction, like Edward Bellamy's hugely successful 1888 utopian novel, Looking Backward, or William Morris's reply 2 years later, News from Nowhere. But in any case, the characterization of the future socialist utopia were being delineated in response and reply to the real-life oppression of capital and its political oligarchy, analyzed and condemned both in the left press of the time and dramatized in what is sometimes seen as the first modern dystopian novel, Jack London's 1908, The Iron Heel. Similarly, what is generally judged one of the first modern feminist utopias, Charlotte Perkins Gilman's Herland, serialized in 1915, though not rediscovered and published in book form until 1979, depicts an ideal community whose ideality inheres precisely in that it has been freed of male rule. All female, reproducing by parthenogenesis. After all, if men are only good for one thing, it turns out you don't even need them for that, why keep them around? The society is able to rethink the gender roles that have hitherto structured and constrained women's freedoms. A follow-up work with her in Our Land sends one of the women from this egalitarian world, along with her new husband, one of the male visitors who discovered it, on a trip back to patriarchal civilization, thereby enabling Gilman as the author, through her protagonist's successive shocks at what she encounters there, to condemn the world we take for granted. In the early 20th century, such work was, of course, very rare. But modern science fiction, originally almost completely male and white, like philosophy, would gradually become more open from the 1960s onward to writing that challenged its standard masculinist and imperialist tropes of planetary conquest of green-skinned natives. Ursula Le Guin, who just died recently, would become one of the giants in the field. Her 1969 gender rethinking novel about a planet of ambisexuals, The Left Hand of Darkness, now seen as a classic. Joanna Russ's The Female Man was narratively constructed across multiple worlds, again, textually setting up the contrast between our own Earth and planets such as Wileaway, where all the men are dead from plague, or at least that's the official story. And parthenogenesis is again the mode of reproduction. The most famous and most reprinted novella of Alice Sheldon, again one of the most distinguished and creative figures in the science fiction of its time, but writing throughout a large part of her career under the self-protective male moniker of James Tiptree Jr., is Houston, Houston, Do You Read?, which describes another post-plague all-female world that the displaced male astronauts who stumble on it try with great cognitive difficulty to understand. Finally, as we all know, Margaret Atwood's dystopic The Handmaid's Tale, though first published way back in 1985, is now on the bestseller lists because of its prize-winning first streaming season on Hulu. As Atwood has pointed out in more than one interview, there's little or nothing in her imagined Republic of Gilead that has not, in fact, been imposed on women by patriarchal society in one time or place or another. Consider now race. Again, we have a situation where the real-life history of black subordination, whether in racial chattel slavery or post-emancipation Jim Crow, has rendered extravagant, counterfactual, dystopic speculation unnecessary. Unlike the punning Greek you and you in Thomas More's original coinage of the term utopia, that is no place and good place, the bad place is very much some place rather than no place, indeed right here and now. Correspondingly, the ideal informed by this reality has always been either racial justice and equality, or if that is impossible, racial escape. Lesbian communities, partially liberated spaces in the larger patriarchal space, are probably the closest white women have come to the physical separation from male domination. But in the maroon communities created by runaway slaves in places such as Cuba and my native Jamaica, or the famous Quilombo of Palmares in Brazil, which lasted almost a century before being destroyed by Portuguese troops, we have realized in reality, not just in fiction, the actual escape from the dystopia of white domination. Afro-modern politics, as has recently come to be termed, is focused on the overcoming of white supremacy. And different diagnoses would give rise to multiple prescriptions for achieving this goal in the specific context of the United States. It encompassed antebellum abolitionism, obviously, but also, when that emancipation did not fulfill the hopes raised by it, a radical reconstruction of the United States on the foundation of racial equality, or the emigrationist solution of return to the ancestral homelands in Africa, or to the artificially created state of Liberia, or what was seen mistakenly as a racial democracy of post-emancipation Brazil, or the dream of carving out on current US terrain a black land of the four or five southern states with the largest percentage black populations. If white women's dystopian and utopian fiction has sometimes placed its hopes in convenient cleansing plagues, black American apocalyptic fiction has envisaged racial insurrection. After all, the Haitian Revolution was not a fantasy. And not just local, but sometimes regional or even global. Martin Delaney's serialized novel, Blake, whose final, presumably climactic chapters have unfortunately been lost, features a protagonist, the titular Blake, who is working to organize a slave uprising, not just in the American South, but the Caribbean. While Sutton Griggs's 1899, Imperium in Imperio, plotted a black takeover of all places, Texas. W.E.B. Du Bois's Dark Princess of 1928 and George Shiloh's 1936-38, The Black International, both depict international coalitions of people of color battling against global white supremacy. Finally, though not fitting the standard Euro definitions of the genre, of dystopia that is, think of slave narratives as examples of individual accounts of the escape from the dystopia of racial chattedom, with its whippings and tortures, or for female slaves in particular, the ever-present threat of rape, where issues of credible testimony don't even arise because your rapists have the right to rape you. So in Harriet Jacobs's Incidents on the Life of a Slave Girl, for example, the tiny garret in which she spent 7 years, which would normally count as a space of confinement and incarceration, becomes for her a utopic space, a haven, a space of safety. Or think of passing novels like James Weldon Johnson's The Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man, whose light-skinned narrator, after the climactic horror of witnessing a lynching by fire, decides to exit dystopic blackness for entry into the utopic protections of whiteness. So in all three subgenres, whether class, gender, or race, the dystopian and the utopian are intimately linked, often being brought together within the same discursive framework, whether political manifestos or work of fiction. The conditions for the subordinated are so bad that little extrapolation is required for their standpoint imaginary to reconstruct dystopia. Often simple description of their situation will do. Correspondingly, by the metric of this dramatically lowered bar, the ideal will often consist simply in getting rid of this non-ideal subordination and attaining the status and protections of their subordinators. This liberation, were it achievable, would be utopia enough. So the epistemology of both kinds of work, political tract and novel, is thus fundamentally oriented by the imperative of revealing the dystopic conditions under which the oppressed have to live. And as a meta-epistemic corollary, the challenging and exposing of the lies and misrepresentations, the multiple cognitive failures, whether motivationally or structurally determined, of the dominant group's epistemology and their implications for the official hegemonic imaginary of the social order will be a crucial part of the emancipatory agenda. These epistemologies of resistance in the recent coinage and work of Jose Medina demand that we listen to and take seriously the alternative experiences and viewpoint of the working class, of white women, of people of color. No ostensible utopia mapped out by the socially privileged that ignores these realities and the need for their correction and elimination can genuinely live up to its name, because it will be predicated precisely on an obtuseness of their significance for the achievement of a genuinely inclusive social justice. Okay, guys, that was part one. I hope you weren't wondering too much, what is this guy talking about? Here now, here now is the connection to the stuff you'll be familiar with. I have taken the long way round, but I trust that you're now beginning to appreciate the relevance of this discussion for Rawls and Rawlsianism, and their pretensions to be delineating a realistic utopia. At this point, I hope my white feminist friends will forgive me if for the remainder of the paper, I focus specifically on race. Remember, Black History Month. The inadequacies of Rawls on gender have been pointed out since the 1970s, most famously in Susan Muller Okin's work. And there is by now a large literature on this theme. But because of the far higher degree of underrepresentation of people of color in the profession and of white women, the critique of his deficiencies on race is not as far as that. Yet if Rawls gives us a maletopia, an androtopia, in the deceptive guise of a genuine inclusive utopia, he also gives us a whiteopia. This might be harder to see considering the explicit condemnation of racism in the book and the prescription of a schedule of basic liberties and a principle of equality of opportunity more radical than the mainstream version, which would certainly go some way to redressing racial injustice. But the problem, in my opinion, as indicated in my title, is the commitment to ideal theory, its epistemology, and the resulting deeply problematic implications for the theorization of justice, not just in the United States, but more generally in the Western nations for which the theory is supposedly self-consciously designed. So epistemic injustice, a wrong both in itself and its instrumental consequences for an adequate theorization of social justice, plays a crucial negative role in the theory. So let me begin by saying something about whiteopia. The coinage is not, alas, my own, but that of African-American writer Rich Benjamin, not a philosopher, but in his 2009 book, Searching for Whiteopia, An Improbable Journey to the Heart of White America. Benjamin was investigating the social phenomenon of white flight to the segregated suburbs and exurbs, where the problems of the inner city are left far behind, out of sight and out of mind. This geographical retreat has been accompanied by a withdrawal from, or perhaps that is too passive a verb, a militant revolt against what were once taken to be public civic obligations, since these transfer payments from the state will be purloined by the racially undeserving. So we get a white self-sequestering in the gated sanctuary of privatized self-sufficiency, represented, of course, in de-raced neoliberal language as personal responsibility. In this sense, the whiteopia is distinctively contemporary, albeit having predecessors in what used to be called the sundown town. So these are little racial Shangri-Las, require not, thank God, actual mountain climbing, but just a somewhat extended commute. However, I want to extend the term metaphorically across time, space, and subject matter to utopian sites in general, both real and imaginary, that are shaped in one way or another by whiteness. Whether characterized by straightforward white racism and white exclusion, or more ambiguous race evasion in the guise of colorblindness, such sites entrench illicit white racial privilege and are typically accompanied by white amnesia, white historical revisionism, and white obfuscation. I suggest that with some simplification, we can distinguish two main varieties of whiteopia, both in practice and in theory. Far from being utterly separate, however, they are causally and discursively linked, the second following from and shaped by the first. In the first variety of whiteopia, white domination is overt and often matter-of-factly proclaimed as such. In the second variety, by contrast, white domination is generally denied and differential white privilege is masked, or whitewashed, would I suppose be the more apposite verb, through a vocabulary and iconography and a normative apparatus which erases the past and present subordination of people of color. Start with the first. In the most extreme version of the overtly racist whiteopia, the problem races are simply exterminated. Nazism can then be seen in Turalia as a vision of an Aryan paradise in which not merely Europe, but the planet as a whole has been made Judenrein, a successful global exercise in race and hygiene. Other inferior races will presumably be allowed to live to fulfill servile functions, except perhaps in cases where they're occupying territory desirable as Lebensraum. It is important to recognize, since blood and soil are once again being invoked, that in some neo-Nazi circles, this dream is still alive and well. Contemporary white supremacist literature in the United States, for example, includes science fiction with similar themes, such as the 1978 Turner Diaries, in which a final apocalyptic race war against both Jews and people of color, here deemed to be serving no useful purpose, leaves the master race in sole possession of the world. But to quickly dispel a self-righteous distancing from such extremism, so contrary to the sanitized and self-serving national narrative, it is important to remind ourselves, especially in a period of resurgent white nationalism, that genocidal projects and fantasies of this ilk are not at all completely disconnected from the mainstream of Western thought, incomprehensible aberrations to be investigated by psychopathology rather than political theory. Whether in the early pioneering work on the link between the Holocaust and imperialism by Hannah Arendt, W.E.B. Du Bois, Amy Césaire and others, or in the growth of recent scholarship on white settler colonialism as a particular variety of socio-political creation, the exterminist impulse has been found to be far more central to the Western tradition than mainstream post-war scholarship, embarrassed by the Nazi death camps, was willing to admit. We have to face the fact, then, that in the various new worlds created by European settlement, not just familiar members of the Anglo world at the United States and Australia, but also many countries in the Hispanic world like Argentina, the obliteration of the old world, first physically and then discursively, was central to the project. Perhaps the first modern anti-genocidal text was Bartolomé de las Casas's 1552, A Short History of the Destruction of the Indians, about the Spanish genocide of indigenous peoples in the Caribbean and what would become Latin America. Closer to home in colonial America, the shining white city on the hill was to be constructed on the expropriated land and dead bodies of those whom Jefferson would later term, in a document simultaneously affirming equal white humanity and denying equal non-white humanity, the quote, merciless Indian savages. So utopia as whiteopia is not at all aberrant. It has indeed been the norm, if not always as genocide, then certainly as racial subordination, the racial instrumentalization of people of color to the serving of white ends and the goal of white racial flourishing. And this reality needs to be confronted rather than evaded for what it says about the West and what is conveniently or is conventionally judged to be its most important political ideology, that is, liberalism. Let me turn now to the second variety of whiteopias, where my categorization will possibly, just possibly, seem a bit more controversial. I'm going to suggest, as already indicated, that in Rawls and the vast secondary literature on Rawlsianism, we have, far from the realistic utopia it pretends to be, another kind of whiteopia. That appropriate for a post-colonial, post-civil rights world in which racism is now officially to be condemned. How could such a judgment be fair, considering the fact of this condemnation in Rawls? The problem is that the idealizations of ideal theory, as developed by Rawls and his disciples, are grounded in a whiteopian project that, in effect, covers up, launders the first whiteopian project. Whiteopianism, in the second sense here, manifests itself not merely, innocently enough, in the goal of a future, perfectly just society, but not innocently at all, in an idealization of the present society and the past society from which it has evolved. It is no longer a matter of the racist denigration of non-whites in theory, or their physical elimination from, or racial subordination within the polity in practice, as with the first category of whiteopia, rather non-whites, via the abstract categories of deontological liberalism, are now assimilated to the status of whites in a fashion that preempts entry into a normative consideration of the distinctive justice problems posed by their presence. Above all, the question of historic and ongoing racial injustice and what would be necessary for its remediation. Rawlsian ideal theory accomplishes, in a sense, a double whiteopianization, an idealization of the present and past in the service of white interests and a white social imaginary, and a corollary whiteopianizing of what would be required by way of social reconstruction to achieve a just society. What is involved is not just a whitewashing of history, that is, a whiting out of the hundreds of years of European colonialism and imperialism, white settlement, often genocidal, indigenous expropriation, racial slavery, but in addition, the creation of a framework intrinsically refractory to the admission of that history. Far from being a realistic utopia, then, it is doubly unrealistic. First, in failing to accurately represent the circumstances of the society and the larger Western created world, and second, operating with a conceptual and normative apparatus structurally inadequate to grasping what would be required to achieve that justice. So section three, here's where I now try to back up these doubtless outrageous seeming claims. So let me now try to back up these claims, utilizing to that end, but remember she's blameless in this, I did not consult with her, utilizing to that end Miranda Fricker's work on epistemic injustice, and trying in addition, perhaps taking on too much in the allocated time, to make a connection to the central liberal ideal of transparency. So Miranda's innovative concept, as mentioned, has been hugely successful, recently stimulating an entire 400-plus page handbook dedicated to its elucidation, the Routledge Handbook of Epistemic Injustice. It would be difficult for anyone to keep up with all the secondary literature, and I know I certainly haven't. So let me say very cautiously that, so far as I know, and based on a quick skim of the handbook's introduction, the idea of epistemic injustice has not been applied reflexively to the theorization of justice itself. So if you know the work of M.C. Escher, and you know the posters were sort of big when I was in grad school, so in a staircase that seemed to go in down and end up, the project may at first seem awkwardly M.C. Escheresque, giving rise to meta upon meta meditations, unilluminating regresses, and unhelpful self-referential infinities. But I suggest that we think about it, we will see that it's actually a natural and straightforward development of the idea. If, with the possible exception of hunter-gatherer societies, social injustice has been the norm rather than the deviation, then we would expect it to affect the cognitive, not just with respect to factual matters, but normative issues also. Unjust societies will not generally proclaim themselves to be such. Even pre-modern social systems, not bound by liberal ideals of democratic consent, usually made some effort at convincing the subordinated that their social position was justified, whether through God's will or their own innate inferiority. To reference a classic left discussion, systems of domination are held in place not just by force, but by ideology. Indeed, ideology is preferable, since if people are mentally subservient to begin with, you will not have to be constantly beating them into subservience. Far from being surprising, then, we would expect that the dominant normative theories of oppressive social orders would be shaped by the need to rationalize the social orders. It is the least remarkable thing in the world. Insofar as the conception of justice exists in such societies, it will generally justify things. And this, of necessity, will involve factual misrepresentations and conceptual obfuscations and rationalizations. So epistemic injustice, Miranda's concept, not as a localized phenomenon, but on a macro scale, will go with the territory. And this will have global implications, not just for the overarching self-characterization of society, but also the particular patterns of the interlocking matrices of their lower-level concepts, assumptions, frameworks, and norms. So if you get things wrong at this level, at the level up here, then you know, all the sort of concepts beneath that, they're going to be affected, they're going to go wrong as well. In an overtly patriarchal society, for example, the concept of gender justice for women will ideally not even exist. Or if it is conceded, some grudging value will be so carefully articulated to other concepts in the patriarchal conceptual grid as to preempt in advance any subversive potential it might have for challenging the system as a whole. Maintaining gender injustice in society will of necessity require epistemic injustice in the theorizing of social justice. So in the left tradition, inspired by Marxism, these issues are handled with the concept of ideology. Though Marxism's weakness on normative matters means that the implications for hegemonic and anti-hegemonic normative theory are not well worked out. But with operating here in the liberal tradition and within its contractarian versions in particular, trying to engage with Rawls and Rawlsianism on what are, at least in part, its own terms. So here's my suggestion. I suggest that we seek to develop, to this end, the concept and ideal of transparency, what Rawls calls publicity. Liberalism demarcates itself from feudal absolutism in part by the norm of having processes of government that, insofar as they're supposed to reflect popular will, should be able to stand up to democratic scrutiny. Utilitarian liberalism, possibly open to advancing of the interests of some citizens over others for the aim of maximizing social welfare, may be forced to shield its calculations from public view. But deontological contractarian liberalism, founded on the sacrosanct rights of each individual, is supposed to be different, most clearly in Kant. The Kantian Rechtsstaat, committed on principle to the trumping of sordid political practice by high-minded moral theory, is supposed to be generally open to civic investigation and sunlight laws, having nothing to hide. Moreover, useful conceptual connections can be made here, both in their similarity and their difference, with the classical political tradition, and the link between individual character, individual virtue, and government character. While the Socratic ideal may be self-transparency, the population as a whole in the ideal Platonic Republic, except perhaps the slaves, who constitute the barely discussed fourth tier, the population as a whole has supposed to be inculcated with the noble lie of the myth of the metals. So personal self-transparency is not supposed to translate into the right to have transparency in the socio-political order. But in a modern liberal democracy, the two transparencies as ideals are at least partially tied, in that people's self-respect, understanding of themselves, and confidence in the worth of their projects is supposed to be underwritten by the societies actually living up to its proclaimed principles of justice and protection of their rights. In addition, the later Rawls, the shift from comprehensive liberalism to a political version, and now more firmly embedded in the actual history of the Western tradition as against other traditions, lays great stress on the overlapping consensus on the values and norms central to that tradition. But suppose the actual history of the polity has been one in which certain individuals were denied a political voice in the first place, not episodically and randomly, but systematically and structurally. And not because of their utilitarian fungibility with other individuals, but because racial norms denied them individual status in the first place. What if the society's liberal pretensions in the real-life Western history, which is now in the later Rawls, supposed to be providing our normative reference point, what if those pretensions have been betrayed from the start, so that the actual liberalism regulating its workings has been racialized, ramifying throughout the basic structure and the interlocking complex of values and norms supposed reflective of an overlapping consensus, so that the boundaries of reasonableness, crucial concept for Rawls, have been set and policed by white racial criteria. Would this have no implications for how we should think of liberal transparency, social justice, and epistemic justice? And the answer is, of course it would, for every one of these ideas. Unlike Marxism, taking structural class oppression and thus non-ideal theory as its starting point, liberalism has not generally theorized social oppression in self-proclaimedly liberal states. The polemical targets have been polities clearly non-liberal. Absolutist monarchy, 20th century totalitarianism, whether fascist or Stalinist, third world dictatorship. So the fate of transparency as a norm and ideal under these circumstances, that is, illiberal, liberal states, has not been a central theoretical focus. But when a liberal society pretending to be a Rechtsstaat is actually a Rassenstaat, a racial state, it will obviously require a principled commitment to a transparency that is really an opacity. So I suggest that this concept, flipping the nominal liberal norm, has resources to do much of the work that ideology has traditionally done in Marxist theory. Moreover, we can now see the direct connection with Fricker's epistemic injustice. Structural social injustice will generate structural opacities that can be thought of as epistemic injustices on an industrial and institutional scale, since they are requisite for maintaining the existing order. And just as systemic oppression is obfuscated or rationalized by misleading factual claims and conceptual framings, so the beneficiaries of the suppression and exploitation need themselves to be self-opaque about their actual complicity with it. Thus, the role of what I've called, and as I say, which I now call the Google Scholar is my most cited essay, white ignorance, or what James Baldwin famously described as white America's innocence, a guilty innocence, to be sure. Consider the two main varieties of epistemic injustice described by Fricker in her book, testimonial and hermeneutical. Ask yourself this simple question. Where in the 2,000 pages of Rawls's 5 books do we hear the voices of any people of color, the victims of this system of racial domination? Martin Luther King Jr. has a brief cameo role in the later work, but this is a token appearance, certainly not involving any engagement with this fundamental critique of a racist white America. It is not that blacks or Native Americans are explicitly deprecated as inferior Noors. After all, we're in the post-civil rights epoch, and such denigration will be completely incompatible with the new norms. But their complete exclusion as competent cognizers speaks for itself. Their testimony is clearly not worth hearing. Moreover, recall the points made in the first section about dystopia and utopia and the epistemic importance in constructing the latter of taking into account the experience and perspective, the imaginaries of the subordinated, experts on the former. After all, while Anglo-American political philosophy may, under Rawls and a few years earlier, Brian Barry, have made the discovery in the 1960s, 70s that social justice should be important to normative political theory, this is very old news in the Black American tradition, or more generally, the Afro-modern tradition. The central theme of diasporic Black political theory, going back at least to the 18th century abolitionist slave narratives of Africans Kwabena Otoba-Kukwuano and Olaudah Equiano, and coming forward through Toussaint Louverture and Dessalines of the Haitian Revolution, and such 19th and 20th century American figures as David Walker, Martin Delaney, Frederick Douglass, W.E.B. Du Bois, Ida B. Wells, James Baldwin, Ralph Ellison, Malcolm X, and many others, not to mention the Jamaican Marcus Garvey, the Trinidadian C.L.R. James and George Padmore, and the Martinican Frantz Fanon. The central theme of all this work has been the condemnation of the injustice of white supremacy in its myriad different incarnations, whether as slavery, postbellum Jim Crow, or European colonial domination. So if you, as John Rawls, are embarking upon a theorization of social justice, especially when in the later work it is explicitly supposed to be a theorization brought down from the abstract, subspecies eternitatis, planetary level, to the localized history in time and space of Western modernity, how can the ignoring of all these predecessors not constitute a major testimonial injustice to them? Especially considering the distinctive moral and epistemic obligations established by the fact that the real-life dystopias were not created by Martian invaders, but by your people, by the white West, including your own native United States. And if it comes so naturally to Rawls, as it obviously does, to read them out of the West and its canonical political theories, how can that not be a tacit admission that for Rawls, the West is essentially the white and privileged, that his justice theory is guided above all by their concerns and priorities and designed accordingly? So shouldn't it then have been highlighted and bolded from the start that the conversation in which you engaged was really one with your co-racials, your fellow white people? And note, by the way, that it cannot be claimed that subsequent Rawlsians and commentators on Rawls have remedied this deficiency. As I have documented in my discussion of Thomas Shelby's article, we find the same exclusions over 40 years in the secondary literature. Most spectacularly, because of its size and its recency of publication, in the 2014 Blackwell Companion to Rawls, co-edited by John Mandel and David Reedy, a book of nearly 600 pages in which race gets about a page and a half, while affirmative action, arguably the single most important post-war measure of corrective racial justice in the United States, gets a single endnote sentence. And not one of the 31 contributors is a person of color. It is an all-white lineup. Let me turn now, in my diminishing time, to hermeneutical injustice, originally characterized by Miranda as, quote, the injustice of having some significant area of one's social experience obscured from collective understanding owing to a structural identity prejudice in the collective hermeneutical resources, end quote. You'll immediately appreciate how readily this idea of obscuring links up with my claims about the structural opacities rather than transparencies typical of nominally liberal states that are in actuality illiberal. It will be the group interests of those privileged by these unjust social orders to deprecate or simply a prioristically exclude in advance the alternative hermeneutical understandings, possibly well developed, possibly only nascent, of the socially subordinated. Opacity, in other words, works in the favor of the dominant group, whether the simple absence of illuminating concepts or, as a more challenging barrier, through the presence and obscurantist role of mystificatory concepts. So it's not merely say that you don't yet have a concept of sexual harassment, but that the conceptual space, so to speak, where it would fit, is already occupied by an alternative androcentric understanding in which sexual advances are a normalized part of human sexual interaction. Now consider the applicability of hermeneutical injustice as a judgment on the Rawlsian ideal theory conceptualization of social justice itself. Take the simple term social justice, a two-word phrase with which we are all familiar. Presumably, an understanding of this phrase requires a preliminary understanding of both society and justice. Well, what is a society of Rawls? His focal conception is the idealized notion of a well-ordered society. So I've identified five conditions. One, a cooperative venture of mutual advantage in which two, the rules are designed for everyone's benefit, and three, people generally follow the rules, and four, a subset of these rules constitute public principles of justice, accepted and known to be accepted by all, and five, the basic social institutions generally satisfy and are known to satisfy these principles. Such a society is one of strict compliance, that is, perfect justice. So it is a utopia. But the real issue I want to focus on is not this overt idealization, which is clearly textually flagged as such, but the tacit idealization underlying it. That is the initial stipulation, roughly points 1 to 3, that we should think of societies as cooperative ventures for mutual advantage in which the rules are designed for everyone's benefit. So here's the problem. Outside of hunter-gatherer societies, and even here, we'd want to know what the latest anthropological consensus, especially among feminist anthropologists, is on the actual sexual division of labor in such communities. Which society in the history of the world has fitted this description? Have most societies in the past few thousand years been patriarchies? Hasn't slavery been widespread across the planet? Even if one is dubious about the Marxist claim that capitalism is necessarily oppressive, haven't pre-modern Western class societies, the slave societies of ancient Greece and Rome, the feudal hierarchies of lord and serf of medieval Europe, haven't these obviously been systems of domination and subordination? Or the early capitalism, without trade unions or worker protection equipment, with child labor and sometimes 16-hour workdays of 19th century Britain? What about modern black racial slavery in the Atlantic world, or the racial slavery in all but name of the Spanish encomienda system for Native Americans? What about forced labor in the Western colonial empires and their body counts? There's an estimated 10 million people who died in King Leopold II's Belgian Congo. So as a descriptive characterization, the conception is clearly absurd. And I should note that various commentators on Rawls, Robert Paul Wolff, Thomas Pogue, Charles Bites, pointed this out from the start. Yet in my opinion, the critical point has never been as developed as fully as it should have been. For if Rawls genuinely believes that this is a concept of society with which we should be working, it means he had a profoundly deluded understanding of the actual world. The possibility of systemic social oppression, of a basic structure founded on exploitation, vanishes. Not as a matter of empirical exploration of humanity's history, but by conceptual fiat, definitional exclusion. Could there be a clearer reading could there be a clearer manifestation, if the reading of Rawls is correct, of hermeneutical injustice on a grand scale, encompassing the entire social order? Far from following the example of those utopian writers oriented by class, gender, and racial concerns, where you begin with a dystopia, you have a social imaginary, an epistemology shaped by them, and you move to utopia, guided by the norm of correcting dystopia, far from following that example, Rawls would be beginning from an already idealized picture of the socio-political situation. The philosopher who for his admirers is the most important theorist of social justice of the 20th century would have given us a conception of the social order which precludes the existence of societies of systemic oppression. Okay, so how do we save Rawls? Well, various moves have been made, sort of suggest that maybe it's an idealized sense, maybe it's just thinking of Western nations. In either case, I'm suggesting he runs into problems. And the concept he works with, the concept he works with in his later work of political liberalism, of liberal democracy, that's also problematic. Because as a concept, liberal democracy has both descriptive and normative aspects. It's basically committed to certain stipulations about the franchise, eligibility to run for office, rule of law, and so forth, as well as being positively valorized. And if you characterize the United States historically as a liberal democracy without paying any attention to its history of racial exclusion, it means that you'd be giving us a profoundly misleading conception of the polity and the basic structure as a whole. And what we need to do instead is draw on the perspectives and the experience of people of color and develop the concept of a racialized basic structure and a white supremacist political system, if not currently, that's a more controversial claim, historically. And insofar as Rawls and theories of justice develop norms and principles and recommendations which basically ignore completely its racial history, it means, as I said, they are involved both in epistemic injustice to their co-citizens as people of color, and in addition, they are basically going to be reproducing a structure of racial injustice which has not been fundamentally challenged over the several hundred years of the Republic's history. So, in a time when race is very much back on the national agenda, in a time when I would like to hope that philosophers have some particular contribution to make, coming from our distinctive strengths, I would suggest to my fellow philosophers categorized as white, it's time to exit Whitetopia. If we want to save our republic and ought to make a contribution to it, the way to do it is to recognize this history and not to obfuscate it, which has both been epistemic and a social injustice. And together, maybe we can contribute to a better United States for all of us. Thank you. Thanks so much, guys. I was trailing off at the end because I really started sweating. I was so hot, I was on the verge of fainting. So the end came just in time. You'd have a dramatic climax, which is not exactly the climax you want. Thank you so much for coming, for staying, and let's sort of, you know, carry the word out. Thank you.
There's now a reception, if you'd like to join us in celebrating more informally.